violently inside the straw. The base of it was thick and heavy, and it made a sound against his skull like a medicine ball dropped on a hardwood floor. He rocked back on his heels, his eyes rolling up in their sockets. The pressure on her throat loosened, then gave way entirely. He put his hands out, as if to steady himself, and then crashed over on his back. Wendy drew a long, sobbing breath. She almost fell herself, clutched the edge of the bar, and managed to hold herself up. Consciousness wavered in and out. She could hear Danny crying, but she had no idea where he was. It sounded like crying in an echo chamber. Dimly, she saw dime-sized drops of blood falling to the dark surface of the bar. From her nose, she thought. She cleared her throat and spat on the floor. It sent a wave of agony up the column of her throat, but the agony subsided to a steady, dull press of pain, just bearable. Little by little, she managed to get control of herself. She let go of the bar, turned around, and saw Jack lying full length, the shattered bottle beside him. He looked like a felled giant. Danny was crouched below the lounge's cash register, both hands in his mouth, staring at his unconscious father. Wendy went to him unsteadily and touched his shoulder. Danny cringed away from her.
"Danny, listen to me."
"No, no,"
he muttered in a husky old man's voice.
"Daddy hurt you. You hurt Daddy. Daddy hurt you. I want to go to sleep. Danny wants to go to sleep.
Danny,
sleep. Sleep. Nighty-night."
"No!"
Pain ripping up her throat again. She winced against it. But he opened his eyes. They looked at her warily, from bluish, shadowed sockets. She made herself speak calmly, her eyes never leaving his. Her voice was low and husky, almost a whisper. It hurt to talk.
"Listen to me, Danny. It wasn't your daddy trying to hurt me, and I didn't want to hurt him. The hotel has gotten into him, Danny. The Overlook has gotten into your daddy. Do you understand me?"
Some kind of knowledge came slowly back into Danny's eyes.
"The bad stuff," he whispered. "There was none of it here before, was there?"
"No. The hotel put it here. The—"
She broke off in a fit of coughing and spat out more blood. Her throat already felt puffed to twice its size.
"The hotel made him drink it. Did you hear those people he was talking to this morning?"
"Yes, the hotel people."
"I heard them too, and that means the hotel is getting stronger. It wants to hurt all of us. But I think, I hope that it can only do that through your daddy. He was the only one it could catch. Are you understanding me, Danny? It's desperately important that you understand. The hotel caught Daddy."
He looked at Jack and groaned helplessly.
"I know you love your daddy. I do too. We have to remember that the hotel is trying to hurt him as much as it is us."
And she was convinced that was true. More, she thought that Danny might be the one the hotel really wanted, the reason it was going so far, maybe the reason it was able to go so far. It might even be that in some unknown fashion, it was Danny's shine that was powering it, the way a battery powers the electrical equipment in a car, the way a battery gets a car to start. If they got out of here, the Overlook might subside to its old, semi-sentient state, able to do no more than present penny dreadful horror slides to the more psychically aware guests who entered it. Without Danny, it was not much more than an amusement park haunted house, where a guest or two might hear rappings or the phantom sounds of a masquerade party, or see an occasional disturbing thing. But if it absorbed Danny, Danny's shine or life force or spirit, whatever you wanted to call it, into itself, what would it be then? The thought made her cold all over.
"I wish Daddy was all better,"
Danny said, and the tears began to flow again.
"Me too,"
she said, and hugged Danny tightly.
"And honey, that's why you've got to help me put your daddy somewhere. Somewhere that the hotel can't make him hurt us, and where he can't hurt himself. Then, if your friend Dick comes, or a park ranger, we can take him away. And I think he might be all right again. All of us might be all right. I think there's still a chance for that, if we're strong and brave, like you were when you jumped on his back. Do you understand?"
She looked at him pleadingly and thought how strange it was. She had never seen him when he looked so much like Jack.
Yes, he said, and nodded. I think if we can get away from here, everything will be like it was. Where could we put him?
The pantry. There's food in there, and a good strong bolt on the outside. It's warm, and we can eat up the things from the refrigerator and the freezer. There will be plenty for all three of us until help comes.
Do we do it now?
Yes, right now, before he wakes up. Danny put the bar gate up while she folded Jack's hands on his chest and listened to his breathing for a moment. It was slow but regular. From the smell of him, she thought he must have drunk a great deal, and he was out of the habit. She thought it might be liquor as much as the crack on the head with the bottle that had put him out. She picked up his legs and began to drag him along the floor. She had been married to him for nearly 7 years. He had lain on top of her countless times, in the thousands, but she had never realized how heavy he was. Her breath whistled painfully in and out of her hurt throat. Nevertheless, she felt better than she had in days. She was alive. Having just brushed so close to death, that was precious. And Jack was alive, too. By blind luck rather than plan, they had perhaps found the only way that would bring them all safely out. Panting harshly, she paused a moment, holding Jack's feet against her hips. The surroundings reminded her of the old seafaring captain's cry in Treasure Island after old blind Pew had passed him the black spot.
We'll do him yet!
And then she remembered uncomfortably that the old sea dog had dropped dead mere seconds later.
Are you all right, Mommy? Is he too heavy?
I'll manage. She began to drag him again. Danny was beside Jack. One of his hands had fallen off his chest, and Danny replaced it gently, with love.
Are you sure, Mommy?
Yes, it's the best thing, Danny.
It's like putting him in jail.
Only for a while.
Okay, then. Are you sure you can do it?
Yes. But it was a near thing at that. Danny had been cradling his father's head when they went over the door sills, but his hands slipped in Jack's greasy hair as they went into the kitchen. The back of his head struck the tiles, and Jack began to moan and stir.
You gotta use smoke, Jack muttered quickly. Now run and get me that gas can.
Wendy and Danny exchanged tight, fearful glances.
Help me,
she said in a low voice. For a moment Danny stood as if paralyzed by his father's face, and then he moved jerkily to her side and helped her hold the left leg. They dragged him across the kitchen floor in a nightmare kind of slow motion, the only sounds the faint, insectile buzz of the fluorescent lights and their own labored breathing. When they reached the pantry, Wendy put Jack's feet down and turned to fumble with the bolt. Danny looked down at Jack, who was lying limp and relaxed again. The shirt tail had pulled out of the back of his pants as they dragged him, and Danny wondered if Daddy was too drunk to be cold. It seemed wrong to lock him in the pantry like a wild animal, but he had seen what he tried to do to Mommy. Even upstairs, he had known Daddy was going to do that. He had heard them arguing in his head.
If only we could all be out of here, or if it was a dream I was having back in Stovington. If only.
The bolt was stuck. Wendy pulled at it as hard as she could, but it wouldn't move. She couldn't retract the goddamn bolt. It was stupid and unfair. She had opened it with no trouble at all when she had gone in to get the can of soup. Now it wouldn't move, and what was she going to do? They couldn't put him in the walk-in refrigerator. He would freeze or smother to death. But if they left him out and he woke up... Jack stirred again on the floor.
I'll take care of it, he muttered. I understand.
He's waking up, Mommy,
Danny warned. Sobbing now, she yanked at the bolt with both hands.
Danny?
There was something softly menacing, if still blurry, in Jack's voice.
That you, old doc?
Just go to sleep, Daddy, Danny said nervously. It's bedtime, you know.
He looked up at his mother, still struggling with the bolt, and saw what was wrong immediately. She had forgotten to rotate the bolt before trying to withdraw it. The little catch was stuck in its notch. Here, he said low, and brushed her trembling hands aside. His own were shaking almost as badly. He knocked the catch loose with the heel of his hand,
and the bolt drew back easily.
Quick, he said.
He looked down. Jack's eyes had fluttered open again, and this time Daddy was looking directly at him, his gaze strangely flat and speculative.
You copied it, Daddy told him. I know you did. But it's here somewhere, and I'll find it. That I promise you. I'll find it.
His words slurred off again. Wendy pushed the pantry door open with her knee, hardly noticing the pungent odor of dried fruit that wafted out. She picked up Jack's feet again and dragged him in. She was gasping harshly now, at the limit of her strength. As she yanked the chain pull that turned on the light, Jack's eyes fluttered open again.
What are you doing, Wendy? What are you doing?
She stepped over him. He was quick, amazingly quick. One hand lashed out, and she had to sidestep and nearly fall out the door to avoid his grasp. Still, he had caught a handful of her bathrobe, and there was a heavy purring noise as it ripped. He was up on his hands and knees now, his hair hanging in his eyes like some heavy animal. A large dog. Or a lion.
Damn you both. I know what you want. But you're not going to get it. This hotel. It's mine. It's me they want. Me. Me!
The door, Danny! She screamed. Shut the door!
He pushed the heavy wooden door shut with a slam just as Jack leaped. The door latched, and Jack thudded uselessly against it. Danny's small hands groped at the bolt. Wendy was too far away to help. The issue of whether he would be locked in or free was going to be decided in 2 seconds. Danny missed his grip, found it again, and shot the bolt across just as the latch began to jiggle madly up and down below it. Then it stayed up, and there was a series of thuds as Jack slammed his shoulder against the door. The bolt, a quarter inch of steel in diameter, showed no signs of loosening. Wendy let her breath out slowly.
Let me out of here! Jack raged. Let me out! Danny, doggone it! This is your father, and I want to get out! Now do what I tell you!
Danny's hand moved automatically toward the bolt. Wendy caught it and pressed it between her breasts.
You mind your daddy, Danny! You do what I say! You do it, or I'll give you a hiding you'll never forget! Open this door, or I'll bash your fucking brains in!
Danny looked at her, pale as window glass. They could hear his breath tearing in and out behind the half inch of solid oak.
Wendy, you let me out. Let me out right now. You cheap, nickel-plated, cold cunt bitch. You let me out. I mean it. Let me out of here, and I'll let it go. If you don't, I'll mess you up. I mean it. I'll mess you up so bad your own mother would pass you on the street. Now open this door.
Danny moaned. Wendy looked at him and saw he was going to faint in a moment.
Come on, Doc, she said, surprised at the calmness of her own voice. It's not your daddy talking, remember. It's the hotel.
Come back here and let me out right now, Jack screamed.
There was a scraping, breaking sound as he attacked the inside of the door with his fingernails.
It's the hotel, Danny said. It's the hotel. I remember.
But he looked back over his shoulder. And his face was crumpled and terrified. 47. Danny. It was 3 p.m. of a long, long day. They were sitting on the big bed in their quarters. Danny was turning the purple VW model with the monster sticking out of the sunroof over and over in his hands, compulsively. They had heard Daddy's batterings at the door all the way across the lobby. The batterings and his voice, hoarse and petulantly angry in a weak king sort of a way, vomiting promises of punishment, vomiting profanity, promising both of them that they would live to regret betraying him after he had slaved his guts out for them over the years. Danny thought they would no longer be able to hear it upstairs, but the sounds of his rage carried perfectly up the dumbwaiter shaft. Mommy's face was pale, and there were horrible brownish bruises on her neck, where Daddy had tried to. He turned the model over and over in his hands, Daddy's prize for having learned his reading lessons, where Daddy had tried to hug her too tight. Mommy put some of her music on the little record player, scratchy and full of horns and flutes.
She smiled at him tiredly. He tried to smile back and failed. Even with the volume turned up loud, he thought he could still hear Daddy screaming at them and battering the pantry door like an animal in a zoo cage. What if Daddy had to go to the bathroom? What would he do then? Danny began to cry. Wendy turned the volume down on the record player at once, held him, rocked him on her lap. Danny, love, it will be all right. It will. If Mr. Halloran didn't get your message, someone else will. As soon as the storm is over. No one could get up here until then anyway, Mr. Halloran or anyone else. But when the storm is over, everything will be fine again. We'll leave here. And do you know what we'll do next spring, the three of us? Danny shook his head against her breasts. He didn't know. It seemed there could never be spring again. We'll go fishing. We'll rent a boat and go fishing, just like we did last year on Chatterton Lake, you and me and your daddy. And maybe you'll catch a bass for our supper. And maybe we won't catch anything, but we're sure to have a good time. I love you, Mommy, he said, and hugged her. Oh, Danny, I love you too. Outside, the wind whooped and screamed. Around 4:30, just as the daylight began to fall, the screams ceased. They had both been dozing uneasily, Wendy still holding Danny in her arms, and she didn't wake. But Danny did. Somehow the silence was worse, more ominous than the screams and the blows against the strong pantry door. Was Daddy asleep again? Or dead? Or what? Did he get out? 15 minutes later, the silence was broken by a hard, grating, metallic rattle. There was a heavy grinding, then a mechanical humming. Wendy came awake with a cry. The elevator was running again. They listened to it, wide-eyed, hugging each other. It went from floor to floor, the grate rattling back, the brass door slamming open. There was laughter, drunken shouts, occasional screams, and the sounds of breakage. The Overlook was coming to life around them. 48. Jack. He sat on the floor of the pantry with his legs out in front of him, a box of Triscuit crackers between them, looking at the door. He was eating the crackers one by one, not tasting them, only eating them because he had to eat something. When he got out of here, he was going to need his strength. All of it. At this precise instant, he thought he had never felt quite so miserable in his entire life. His mind and body together made up a large writ scripture of pain. His head ached terribly, the sick throb of a hangover. The attendant symptoms were there, too. His mouth tasted like a manure rake had taken a swing through it. His ears rang. His heart had an extra heavy, thudding beat like a tom-tom. In addition, both shoulders ached fiercely from throwing himself against the door, and his throat felt raw and peeled from useless shouting. He had cut his right hand on the door latch. And when he got out of here, he was going to kick some ass. He munched the Triscuits one by one, refusing to give in to his wretched stomach, which wanted to vomit up everything. He thought of the Excedrins in his pocket and decided to wait until his stomach had quieted a bit. No sense swallowing a painkiller if you were going to throw it right back up. Have to use your brain. The celebrated Jack Torrance brain. Aren't you the fellow who once was going to live by his wits? Jack Torrance, best-selling author? Jack Torrance, acclaimed playwright and winner of the New York Critics Circle Award. John Torrance, man of letters, esteemed thinker. Winner of the Pulitzer Prize at 70 for his trenchant book of memoirs, My Life in the 20th Century. All any of that shit boiled down to was living by your wits. Living by your wits is always knowing where the wasps are. He put another Triscuit into his mouth and crunched it up. What it really came down to, he supposed, was their lack of trust in him. Their failure to believe that he knew what was best for them and how to get it. His wife had tried to usurp him, first by fair, sort of, means, then by foul. When her little hints and whining objections had been overturned by his own well-reasoned arguments,
She had turned his boy against him, tried to kill him with a bottle, and then had locked him, of all places, in the goddamned fucking pantry. Still, a small interior voice nagged him. Yes, but where did the liquor come from? Isn't that really the central point? You know what happens when you drink. You know it from bitter experience. When you drink, you lose your wits. He hurled the box of Triscuits across the small room. They struck a shelf of canned goods and fell to the floor. He looked at the box, wiped his lips with his hand, and then looked at his watch. It was almost 6:30. He had been in here for hours. His wife had locked him in here, and he'd been here for fucking hours. He could begin to sympathize with his father. The thing he'd never asked himself, Jack realized now, was exactly what had driven his daddy to drink in the first place. And really, when you came right down to what his old students had been pleased to call the nitty-gritty, hadn't it been the woman he was married to? A milksop sponge of a woman, always dragging silently around the house with an expression of doomed martyrdom on her face? A ball and chain around Daddy's ankle? No, not ball and chain. She had never actively tried to make Daddy a prisoner the way Wendy had done to him. For Jack's father, it must have been more like the fate of McTeague the dentist at the end of Frank Norris's great novel, handcuffed to a dead man in the wasteland. Yes, that was better. Mentally and spiritually dead, his mother had been handcuffed to his father by matrimony. Still, Daddy had tried to do right as he dragged her rotting corpse through life. He had tried to bring the four children up to know right from wrong, to understand discipline, and above all, to respect their father. Well, they had been ingrates, all of them, himself included. And now he was paying the price. His own son had turned out to be an ingrate, too. But there was hope. He would get out of here somehow. He would chastise them both, and harshly. He would set Danny an example, so that the day might come when Danny was grown, a day when Danny would know what to do better than he himself had known. He remembered the Sunday dinner when his father had caned his mother at the table, how horrified he and the others had been. Now he could see how necessary that had been, how his father had only been feigning drunkenness, how his wits had been sharp and alive underneath all along, watching for the slightest sign of disrespect. Jack crawled after the Triscuits and began to eat them again, sitting by the door she had so treacherously bolted. He wondered exactly what his father had seen and how he had caught her out by his play-acting. Had she been sneering at him behind her hand, sticking her tongue out, making obscene finger gestures, or only looking at him insolently and arrogantly, convinced that he was too stupidly drunk to see? Whatever it had been, he had caught her at it, and he had chastised her sharply. And now, 20 years later, he could finally appreciate Daddy's wisdom. Of course you could say Daddy had been foolish to marry such a woman, to have handcuffed himself to that corpse in the first place, and a disrespectful corpse at that. But when the young marry in haste, they must repent in leisure. And perhaps Daddy's daddy had married the same type of woman, so that unconsciously Jack's daddy had also married one, as Jack himself had. Except that his wife, instead of being satisfied with the passive role of having wrecked one career and crippled another, had opted for the poisonously active task of trying to destroy his last and best chance, to become a member of the Overlook staff, and possibly to rise all the way to the position of manager in time. She was trying to deny him Danny, and Danny was his ticket of admission. That was foolish, of course. Why would they want the son when they could have the father? But employers often had foolish ideas, and that was the condition that had been made. He wasn't going to be able to reason with her, he could see that now. He had tried to reason with her in the Colorado lounge, and she had refused to listen, had hit him over the head with a bottle for his pains. But there would be another time, and soon. He would get out of here. He suddenly held his breath and cocked his head. Somewhere, a piano was playing boogie-woogie, and people were laughing and clapping along. The sound was muffled through the heavy wooden door, but audible. The song was, "There'll be a hot time in the old town tonight." His hands curled helplessly into fists. He had to restrain himself from battering at the door with them.
The party had begun again. The liquor would be flowing freely. Somewhere, dancing with someone else, would be the girl who had felt so maddeningly nude under her white silk gown.
"You'll pay for this!"
he howled.
"God damn you two! You'll pay! You'll take your goddamn medicine for this, I promise you! You—"
"Here, here now," a mild voice said just outside the door. "No need to shout, old fellow. I can hear you perfectly well." Jack lurched to his feet.
"Grady? Is that you?"
"Yes, sir. Indeed it is. You appear to have been locked in."
"Let me out, Grady. Quickly."
"I see you can hardly have taken care of the business we discussed, sir. The correction of your wife and son."
"They're the ones who locked me in. Pull the bolt, for God's sake."
"You let them lock you in?" Grady's voice registered well-bred surprise. "Oh, dear. A woman half your size, and a little boy? Hardly sets you off as being of top managerial timber, does it?" A pulse began to beat in the clock spring of veins at Jack's right temple.
"Let me out, Grady. I'll take care of them."
"Will you indeed, sir? I wonder." Well-bred surprise was replaced by well-bred regret. "I'm pained to say that I doubt it. I and others have really come to believe that your heart is not in this, sir. That you haven't the belly for it."
"I do!"
Jack shouted.
"I do! I swear it!"
"You would bring us your son?"
"Yes! Yes!"
"Your wife would object to that very strongly, Mr. Torrance, and she appears to be somewhat stronger than we had imagined, somewhat more resourceful. She certainly seems to have gotten the better of you." Grady tittered. "Perhaps, Mr. Torrance, we should have been dealing with her all along."
"I'll bring him, I swear it,"
Jack said. His face was against the door now. He was sweating.
"She won't object. I swear she won't. She won't be able to."
"You would have to kill her, I fear," Grady said coldly.
"I'll do what I have to do. Just let me out."
"You'll give your word on it, sir?" Grady persisted.
"My word, my promise, my sacred vow, whatever in hell you want. If you—"
There was a flat snap as the bolt was drawn back. The door shivered open a quarter of an inch. Jack's words and breath halted. For a moment he felt that death itself was outside that door. The feeling passed. He whispered,
"Thank you, Grady. I swear you won't regret it. I swear you won't."
There was no answer. He became aware that all sounds had stopped except for the cold swooping of the wind outside. He pushed the pantry door open. The hinges squealed faintly. The kitchen was empty. Grady was gone. Everything was still and frozen beneath the cold white glare of the fluorescent bars. His eyes caught on the large chopping block where the three of them had eaten their meals. Standing on top of it was a martini glass, a fifth of gin, and a plastic dish filled with olives. Leaning against it was one of the roque mallets from the equipment shed. He looked at it for a long time. Then a voice, much deeper and much more powerful than Grady's, spoke from somewhere, everywhere, from inside him.
"Keep your promise, Mr. Torrance."
"I will," he said. He heard the fawning servility in his own voice, but was unable to control it.
"I will."
He walked to the chopping block and put his hand on the handle of the mallet. He hefted it, swung it. It hissed viciously through the air. Jack Torrance began to smile.
49. Halloran, going up the country. It was quarter of two in the afternoon, and according to the snow-clotted signs and the Hertz Buick's odometer, he was less than 3 miles from Estes Park when he finally went off the road. In the hills, the snow was falling faster and more furiously than Halloran had ever seen, which was perhaps not to say a great deal, since Halloran had seen as little snow as he could manage in his lifetime, and the wind was blowing a capricious gale, now from the west, now backing around to the north, sending clouds of powdery snow across his field of vision, making him coldly aware again and again that if he missed a turn he might well plunge 200 feet off the road, the Electra cartwheeling ass over teapot as it went down. Making it worse was his own amateur status as a winter driver. It scared him to have the yellow center line buried under swirling, drifting snow, and it scared him when the heavy gusts of wind came unimpeded through the notches in the hills and actually made the heavy Buick slew around. It scared him that the road information signs were mostly masked with snow, and you could flip a coin as to whether the road was going to break right for left up ahead in the white drive-in movie screen he seemed to be driving through. He was scared, all right. He had driven in a cold sweat since climbing into the hills west of Boulder and Lyons, handling the accelerator and brake as if they were Ming vases. Between rock and roll tunes on the radio, the disc jockey constantly adjured motorists to stay off the main highways and under no conditions to go into the mountains because many roads were impassable and all of them were dangerous. Scores of minor accidents had been reported, and two serious ones. A party of skiers in a VW microbus, and a family that had been bound for Albuquerque through the Sangre de Cristo Mountains. The combined score on both was 4 dead and 5 wounded. "So stay off those roads and get into the good music here at KTLK," the jock concluded cheerily, and then compounded Halloran's misery by playing Seasons in the Sun. "We had joy, we had fun, we had..." Terry Jacks gibbered happily, and Halloran snapped the radio off viciously, knowing he would have it back on in 5 minutes. No matter how bad it was better than riding alone through this white madness. "Admit it. This here black boy has got at least one long stripe of yaller, and it runs right up his ever-loving back." It wasn't even funny. He would have backed off before he even cleared Boulder if it hadn't been for his compulsion that the boy was in terrible trouble. Even now, a small voice in the back of his skull, more the voice of reason than of cowardice, he thought, was telling him to hole up in an Estes Park motel for the night and wait for the plows to at least expose the center stripe again. That voice kept reminding him of the jet's shaky landing at Stapleton, of that sinking feeling that it was going to come in nose first, delivering its passengers to the gates of hell rather than at Gate 39, Concourse B. But reason would not stand against the compulsion. It had to be today. The snowstorm was his own bad luck. He would have to cope with it. He was afraid that if he didn't, he might have something much worse to cope with in his dreams. The wind gusted again, this time from the northeast, a little English on the ball, if you please, and he was again cut off from the vague shapes of the hills and even from the embankments on either side of the road. He was driving through white null. And then, the high sodium lights of the snowplow loomed out of the soup, bearing down, and to his horror he saw that instead of being to one side, the Buick's nose was pointed directly between those headlamps. The plow was being none too choosy about keeping its own side of the road, and Halloran had allowed the Buick to drift. The grinding roar of the plow's diesel engine intruded over the bellow of the wind, and then the sound of its air horn, hard, long, almost deafening. Halloran's testicles turned into 2 small wrinkled sacks filled with shaved ice. His gut seemed to have been transformed into a large mass of silly putty. Color was materializing out of the white now, snow-clotted orange. He could see the high cab, even the gesticulating figure of the driver behind the single long wiper blade. He could see the V-shape of the plow's wing blades spewing more snow up onto the road's left-hand embankment like pallid, smoking exhaust. "Wah!" the air horn bellowed indignantly. He squeezed the accelerator like the breast of a much-loved woman, and the Buick scooted forward and toward the right. There was no embankment over here. The plows headed up instead of down had only to push the snow directly over the drop. The drop. Ah, yes. The drop. The wing blades on Halloran's left, fully 4 feet higher than the Electra's roof, flirted by with no more than an inch or two to spare. Until the plow had actually cleared him, Halloran had thought a crash inevitable. A prayer which was half an inarticulate apology to the boy flitted through his mind like a torn rag. Then the plow was passed, its revolving blue lights glinting and flashing in Halloran's rearview mirror. He jockeyed the Buick steering wheel back to the left, but nothing doing. The scoot had turned into a skid, and the Buick was floating dreamily toward the lip of the drop, spuming snow from under its mudguards. He flicked the wheel back the other way, in the skid's direction, and the car's front and rear began to swap places. Panicked now, he pumped the brake hard and then felt a hard bump. In front of him the road was gone. He was looking into a bottomless chasm of swirling snow and vague greenish-gray pines far away and far below. I'm going, Holy Mother of Jesus, I'm going off. And that was where the car stopped, canting forward at a 30-degree angle, the left fender jammed against a guardrail, the rear wheels nearly off the ground. When Halloran tried reverse, the wheels only spun helplessly. His heart was doing a Gene Krupa drum roll. He got out. Very carefully he got out, and went around to the Buick's back deck. He was standing there, looking at the back wheels helplessly, when a cheerful voice behind him said, "Hello there, fella. You must be shit right out of your mind." He turned around and saw the plow 40 yards further down the road, obscured in the blowing snow except for the raftered dark brown streak of its exhaust and the revolving blue lights on top. The driver was standing just behind him, dressed in a long sheepskin coat and a slicker over it. A blue and white pinstriped engineer's cap was perched on his head, and Halloran could hardly believe it was staying on in the teeth of the wind.
Glue. It sure God must be glue.
Hi, he said. Can you pull me back onto the road? Oh, I guess I could, the plow driver said. What the hell you doing way up here, mister? Good way to kill your ass.
Urgent business.
Nothing is that urgent, the plow driver said slowly and kindly, as if speaking to a mental defective. If you'd have hit that post a little mite harder, nobody would have got you out till All Fool's Day. Don't come from these parts, do you?
No, and I wouldn't be here unless my business was as urgent as I say.
That's so. The driver shifted his stance companionably, as if they were having a desultory chat on the back steps instead of standing in a blizzard halfway between hoot and holler, with Halloran's car balanced 300 feet above the tops of the trees below. Where you headed? Estes?
No. A place called the Overlook Hotel, Halloran said. It's a little way above Sidewinder.
But the driver was shaking his head dolefully.
I guess I know well enough where that is, he said. Mister, you'll never get up to the old Overlook. Roads between Estes Park and Sidewinder is bloody damn hell. It's drifting in right behind us no matter how hard we push. I come through drifts a few miles back that was damn near 6 feet through the middle. And even if you could make Sidewinder, why, the road's closed from there all the way across to Buckland, Utah.
Nope.
He shook his head. Never make it, mister. Never make it at all.
I have to try, Halloran said, calling on his last reserves of patience to keep his voice normal.
There's a boy up there.
Boy? No. The Overlook closes down at the last end of September. No percentage keeping it open longer. Too many shitstorms like this.
He's the son of the caretaker. He's in trouble.
Well, how would you know that?
His patience snapped. For Christ's sake, are you going to stand there and flap your jaw at me the rest of the day? I know. I know. Now, are you going to pull me back on the road or not?
Kind of testy, aren't you? The driver observed, not particularly perturbed. Sure, get back in there. I got a chain behind the seat.
Halloran got back behind the wheel, beginning to shake with delayed reaction now. His hands were numbed almost clear through. He had forgotten to bring gloves.
The plow backed up to the rear of the Buick, and he saw the driver get out with a long coil of chain. Halloran opened the door and shouted,
"What can I do to help?"
"Stay out of the way, is all," the driver shouted back. "This ain't gonna take a blink."
Which was true. A shudder ran through the Buick's frame as the chain pulled tight, and a second later it was back on the road, pointed more or less toward Estes Park. The plow driver walked up beside the window and knocked on the safety glass. Halloran rolled down the window.
"Thanks," he said.
"I'm sorry I shouted at you."
"I've been shouted at before," the driver said with a grin. "I guess you're sort of strung up. You take these."
A pair of bulky blue mittens dropped into Halloran's lap.
"You'll need 'em when you go off the road again, I guess. Cold out. You wear 'em unless you want to spend the rest of your life picking your nose with a crocheting hook. And you send 'em back. My wife knitted 'em, and I'm partial to 'em. Name and address is sewed right into the lining. I'm Howard Cottrell, by the way. You just send 'em back when you don't need 'em anymore. And I don't want to have to go paying no postage due, mind."
"All right," Halloran said. "Thanks. One hell of a lot."
"You be careful. I'd take you myself, but I'm busy as a cat in a mess of guitar strings."
"That's okay. Thanks again."
He started to roll up the window, but Cottrell stopped him.
When you get to Sidewinder, if you get to Sidewinder, you go to Durkin's Canoco. It's right next to the library. Can't miss it. You ask for Larry Durkin. Tell him Howie Cottrell sent you and you want to rent one of his snowmobiles. You mention my name and show those mittens, you'll get the cut rate.
Thanks again, Halloran said. Cottrell nodded.
It's funny. Ain't no way you could know someone's in trouble up there at the Overlook. The phone's out, sure as hell. But I believe you. Sometimes I get feelings.
Halloran nodded. Sometimes I do, too.
Yeah, I know you do. But you take care.
I will. Cottrell disappeared into the blowing dimness with a final wave, his engineer cap still mounted perkily on his head. Halloran got going again, the chains flailing at the snow cover on the road, finally digging in enough to start the Buick moving. Behind him, Howard Cottrell gave a final good-luck blast on his plow's air horn, although it was really unnecessary. Halloran could feel him wishing him good luck. That's two shines in one day, he thought, and that ought to be some kind of good omen. But he distrusted omens, good or bad, and meeting two people with the shine in one day, when he usually didn't run across more than four or five in the course of a year, might not mean anything. That feeling of finality, a feeling like things are all wrapped up, he could not completely define, was still very much with him. It was the Buick wanted to skid sideways around a tight curve, and Halloran jockeyed it carefully, hardly daring to breathe. He turned on the radio again, and it was Aretha, and Aretha was just fine. He'd share his Hertz Buick with her any day. Another gust of wind struck the car, making it rock and slip around. Halloran cursed it and hunched more closely over the wheel. Aretha finished her song, and then the jock was on again, telling him that driving today was a good way to get killed. Halloran snapped the radio off. He did make it to Sidewinder, although he was 4.5 hours on the road between Estes Park and there. By the time he got to the upland highway, it was full dark, but the snowstorm showed no sign of abating. Twice he'd had to stop in front of drifts that were as high as his car's hood and wait for the plows to come along and knock holes in them. At one of the drifts, the plow had come up on his side of the road, and there had been another close call. The driver had merely swung around his car, not getting out to chew the fat, but he did deliver one of the two finger gestures that all Americans above the age of 10 recognize, and it was not the peace sign. It seemed that as he drew closer to the Overlook, his need to hurry became more and more compulsive. He found himself glancing at his wristwatch almost constantly. The hands seemed to be flying along. 10 minutes after he had turned onto the upland, he passed two signs. The whooping wind had cleared both of their snowpack, so he was able to read them. Sidewinder 10, the first said. The second, road closed 12 miles ahead during winter months. Larry Durkin, Halloran muttered to himself. His dark face was strained and tense in the muted green glow of the dashboard instruments. It was 6:10. The Canoco by the library. Larry. And that was when it struck him, full force. The smell of oranges and the thought force, heavy and hateful, murderous.
Get out of here, you dirty nigger. This is none of your business, you nigger. Turn around, or we'll kill you. Hang you up from a tree limb, you fucking jungle bunny coon, and then burn the body. That's what we do with niggers. So turn around now.
Halloran screamed in the close confines of the car. The message did not come to him in words, but in a series of rebus-like images that were slammed into his head with terrific force. He took his hands from the steering wheel to blot the pictures out. Then the car smashed broadside into one of the embankments, rebounded, slewed halfway around, and came to a stop. The rear wheels spun uselessly. Halloran snapped the gear shift into park and then covered his face with his hands. He did not precisely cry. What escaped him was an uneven ha-ha-ha sound. His chest heaved. He knew that if that blast had taken him on a stretch of road with a drop-off on one side or the other, he might well be dead now. Maybe that had been the idea. And it might hit him again, at any time. He would have to protect against it. He was surrounded by a red force of immense power that might have been memory. He was drowning in instinct. He took his hands away from his face and opened his eyes cautiously. Nothing. If there was something trying to scare him again, it wasn't getting through. He was closed off. Had that happened to the boy?
Dear God, had that happened to the little boy? And of all the images, the one that bothered him the most was that dull whacking sound, like a hammer splatting into thick cheese. What did that mean?
Jesus, not that little boy. Jesus, please.
He dropped the gear shift lever into low range and fed the engine gas a little at a time. The wheel spun, caught, spun, and caught again. The Buick began to move, its headlights cutting weakly through the swirling snow. He looked at his watch. Almost 6:30 now, and he was beginning to feel that was very late indeed. 50. Red Rum. Wendy Torrance stood indecisive in the middle of the bedroom, looking at her son who had fallen fast asleep. Half an hour ago the sounds had ceased, all of them, all at once. The elevator, the party, the sound of room doors opening and closing. Instead of easing her mind, it made the tension that had been building in her even worse. It was like a malefic hush before the storm's final brutal push. But Danny had dozed off almost at once, first into a light, twitching doze, and in the last 10 minutes or so, a heavier sleep. Even looking directly at him, she could barely see the slow rise and fall of his narrow chest. She wondered when he had last gotten a full night's sleep, one without tormenting dreams or long periods of dark wakefulness, listening to revels that had only become audible and visible to her in the last couple of days, as the Overlook's grip on the three of them tightened. Real psychic phenomena or group hypnosis? She didn't know, and didn't think it mattered. What had been happening was just as deadly either way. She looked at Danny and thought, God grant he lie still, that if he was undisturbed, he might sleep the rest of the night through. Whatever talent he had, he was still a small boy, and he needed his rest. It was Jack she had begun to worry about. She grimaced with sudden pain, took her hand away from her mouth, and saw she had torn off one of her fingernails. And her nails were one thing she'd always tried to keep nice. They weren't long enough to be called hooks, but still nicely shaped, and what are you worrying about your fingernails for? She laughed a little, but it was a shaky sound, without amusement. First, Jack had stopped howling and battering at the door. Then the party had begun again. Or did it ever stop? Did it sometimes just drift into a slightly different angle of time where they weren't meant to hear it, counterpointed by the crashing, banging elevator? Then that had stopped. In that new silence, as Danny had been falling asleep, she had fancied she heard low, conspiratorial voices coming from the kitchen almost directly below them. At first she had dismissed it as the wind, which could mimic many different human vocal ranges, from a papery deathbed whisper around the doors and window frames to a full-out scream around the eaves, the sound of a woman fleeing a murderer in a cheap melodrama. Yet sitting stiffly beside Danny, the idea that it was indeed voices became more and more convincing. Jack and someone else, discussing his escape from the pantry. Discussing the murder of his wife and son. It would be nothing new inside these walls. Murder had been done here before. She had gone to the heating vent and had placed her ear against it, but at that exact moment the furnace had come on, and any sound was lost in the rush of warm air coming up from the basement. When the furnace had kicked off again 5 minutes ago, the place was completely silent except for the wind, the gritty spatter of snow against the building, and the occasional groan of a board. She looked down at her ripped fingernail. Small beads of blood were oozing up from beneath it.
Jack's gotten out. Don't talk nonsense. Yes, he's out. He's gotten a knife from the kitchen, or maybe the meat cleaver. He's on his way up here right now, walking along the sides of the risers so the stairs won't creak. You're insane!
Her lips were trembling, and for a moment it seemed that she must have cried the words out loud, but the silence held. She felt watched. She whirled around and stared at the night-blackened window. And a hideous white face with circles of darkness for eyes was gibbering in at her, the face of a monstrous lunatic that had been hiding in these groaning walls all along. It was only a pattern of frost on the outside of the glass. She let her breath out in a long, susurrating whisper of fear, and it seemed to her that she heard, quite clearly this time, amused titters from somewhere.
You're jumping at shadows. It's bad enough without that. By tomorrow morning you'll be ready for the rubber room.
There was only one way to allay those fears, and she knew what it was. She would have to go down and make sure Jack was still in the pantry. Very simple. Go downstairs, have a peek, come back up. Oh, by the way, stop and grab the tray on the registration counter. The omelet would be a washout, but the soup could be reheated on the hot plate by Jack's typewriter.
Oh, yes. And don't get killed if he's down there with a knife.
She walked to the dresser, trying to shake off the mantle of fear that lay on her. Scattered across the dresser's top was a pile of change, a stack of gasoline chits for the hotel truck, the two pipes Jack brought with him everywhere but rarely smoked, and his key ring. She picked it up, held it in her hand for a moment, and then put it back down. The idea of locking the bedroom door behind her had occurred, but it just didn't appeal. Danny was asleep. Vague thoughts of fire passed through her mind, and something else nibbled more strongly, but she let it go. Wendy crossed the room, stood indecisively by the door for a moment, then took the knife from the pocket of her robe and curled her right hand around the wooden haft. She pulled the door open. The short corridor leading to their quarters was bare. The electric wall flambeaux all shone brightly at their regular intervals, showing off the rug's blue background and sinuous weaving pattern.
See? No boogies here.
No, of course not. They want you out. They want you to do something silly and womanish, and that is exactly what you are doing. She hesitated again, miserably caught, not wanting to leave Danny and the safety of the apartment, and at the same time needing badly to reassure herself that Jack was still safely packed away.
Of course he is. But the voices, there were no voices, it was your imagination, it was the wind.
It wasn't the wind. The sound of her own voice made her jump, but the deadly certainty in it made her go forward. The knife swung by her side, catching angles of light and throwing them on the silk wallpaper. Her slippers whispered against the carpet's nap. Her nerves were singing like wires. She reached the corner of the main corridor and peered around, her mind stiffened for whatever she might see there. There was nothing to see. After a moment's hesitation, she rounded the corner and began down the main corridor. Each step toward the shadowy stairwell increased her dread and made her aware that she was leaving her sleeping son behind, alone and unprotected. The sound of her slippers against the carpet seemed louder and louder in her ears. Twice she looked back over her shoulder to convince herself that someone wasn't creeping up behind her. She reached the stairwell and put her hand on the cold newel post at the top of the railing. There were 19 wide steps down to the lobby. She had counted them enough times to know. 19 carpeted stair risers, and nary a Jack crouching on any one of them. Of course not. Jack was locked in the pantry behind a hefty steel bolt and a thick wooden door. But the lobby was dark, and oh, so full of shadows. Her pulse thudded steadily and deeply in her throat. Ahead and slightly to the left, the brass yaw of the elevator stood mockingly open, inviting her to step in and take the ride of her life. No thank you. The inside of the car had been draped with pink and white crepe streamers. Confetti had burst from two tubular party favors. Lying in the rear left corner was an empty bottle of champagne. She sensed movement above her and wheeled to look up the 19 steps leading to the dark second-floor landing and saw nothing. Yet there was a disturbing corner-of-the-eye sensation that things, had leaped back into the deeper darkness of the hallway up there just before her eyes could register them. She looked down the stairs again. Her right hand was sweating against the wooden handle of the knife. She switched it to her left, wiped her right palm against the pink terry cloth of her robe, and switched the knife back. Almost unaware that her mind had given her body the command to go forward, she began down the stairs, left foot then right, left foot then right, her free hand trailing lightly on the banister.
Where's the party? Don't let me scare you away, you bunch of moldy sheets. Not one scared woman with a knife. Let's have a little music around here. Let's have a little life.
10 steps down. A dozen. A baker's dozen. The light from the first floor hall filtered a dull yellow down here, and she remembered that she would have to turn on the lobby lights either beside the entrance to the dining room or inside the manager's office. yet there was light coming from somewhere else, white and muted. The fluorescence, of course. In the kitchen. She paused on the 13th step, trying to remember if she had turned them off or left them on when she and Danny left. She simply couldn't remember. Below her in the lobby, high-backed chairs hulked in pools of shadow. The glass in the lobby doors was pressed white with a uniform blanket of drifted snow. Brass studs in the sofa cushions gleamed faintly, like cat's eyes. There were 100 places to hide. Her legs stilted with fear. She continued down. Now 17, now 18, now 19. Lobby level, madam. Step out carefully. The ballroom doors were thrown wide, only blackness spilling out. From within came a steady ticking, like a bomb. She stiffened, then remembered the clock on the mantel, the clock under glass. Jack or Danny must have wound it. Or maybe it had wound itself up, like everything else in the Overlook. She turned toward the reception desk, meaning to go through the gate and the manager's office and into the kitchen. Gleaming dull silver, she could see the intended lunch tray. Then the clock began to strike, little tinkling notes. Wendy stiffened, her tongue rising to the roof of her mouth. Then she relaxed. It was striking 8, that was all. 8 o'clock. 5, 6, 7. She counted the strokes. It suddenly seemed wrong to move again until the clock had stilled. 8, 9, 9, 10, 11. Suddenly, belatedly, it came to her. She turned back clumsily for the stairs, knowing already she was too late. But how could she have known? 12. All the lights in the ballroom went on. There was a huge, shrieking flourish of brass. Wendy screamed aloud, the sound of her cry insignificant against the blare issuing from those brazen lungs. "Unmask!" the cry echoed. "Unmask! Unmask!" Then they faded, as if down a long corridor of time, leaving her alone again. No, not alone. She turned, and he was coming for her. It was Jack, and yet not Jack. His eyes were lit with a vacant, murderous glow. His familiar mouth now wore a quivering, joyless grin. He had the roque mallet in one hand.
"Thought you'd lock me in? Is that what you thought you'd do?"
The mallet whistled through the air. She stepped backward, tripped over a hassock, fell to the lobby rug.
"Jack?" "You bitch," he whispered. "I know what you are."
The mallet came down again with whistling, deadly velocity and buried itself in her soft stomach. She screamed, suddenly submerged in an ocean of pain. Dimly she saw the mallet rebound. It came to her with sudden, numbing reality that he meant to beat her to death with the mallet he held in his hands. She tried to cry out to him again, to beg him to stop for Danny's sake, but her breath had been knocked loose. She could only force out a weak whimper. Hardly a sound at all.
Now, by Christ, he said, grinning.
He kicked the hassock out of his way.
I guess you'll take your medicine now.
The mallet wickered down. Wendy rolled to her left, her robe tangling above her knees. Jack's hold on the mallet was jarred loose when it hit the floor. He had to stoop and pick it up, and while he did, she ran for the stairs, the breath at last sobbing back into her. Her stomach was a bruise of throbbing pain.
"Bitch!"
he said through his grin, and began to come after her.
"You stinking bitch! I guess you'll get what's coming to you. I guess you will."
She heard the mallet whistle through the air, and then agony exploded on her right side as the mallet head took her just below the line of her breasts, breaking 2 ribs. She fell forward on the steps, and new agony ripped her as she struck on the wounded side. Yet instinct made her roll over, roll away, and the mallet whizzed past the side of her face, missing by a naked inch. It struck the deep pile of the stair carpeting with a muffled thud. That was when she saw the knife, which had been jarred out of her hand by her fall. It lay glittering on the 4th stair riser.
"Bitch!"
he repeated. The mallet came down. She shoved herself upward, and it landed just below her kneecap. Her lower leg was suddenly on fire. Blood began to trickle down her calf. and then the mallet was coming down again. She jerked her head away from it, and it smashed into the stair riser in the hollow between her neck and shoulder, scraping away the flesh from her ear.